Next Chapter Podcasts.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Michael Goodfriend, executive producer of the Play On Podcasts. Brian Quijada is an Emmy-nominated playwright, actor, and composer whose original work has been developed and produced all over this country. His hip-hop solo, Where Did We Sit on the Bus, has been produced at Ensemble Studio Theater and got a Drama Desk nomination in Solo Performance and Sound Design, Teatro Vista, Jeff Award in Solo Performance and Sound Design, Victory Garden, City Theater, Pittsburgh, Jiva Theater, all over this country. His theater for young audience play Kid Prince and Pablo premiered at Kennedy Center in 2019. And most recently, his cumbia hip-hop musical Somewhere Over the Border had a critically acclaimed rolling world premiere at Syracuse Stage, Jiva Theater, and Teatro Vista. His plays have been developed at the Kennedy Center, Ars Nova, AntFest, Victory Gardens, Ignition Festival, lots and lots of things, lots and lots of places. The Eugene O'Neill Theater Center National Music Theater Conference. I tried to get my stuff in there. I got pretty close, but yeah. No cigar. You did, though. You got it through. You got it over the threshold.
Yeah, after many attempts of, like, definitely not getting it.
Perseverance, man.
That's true.
You've been commissioned by everybody. ART in Boston, First Stage, Oregon Shakespeare Festival. We know that place. Woolly Mammoth, Hero Theater, the great Elisa Bocanegra. Runs yes. That place, the Kennedy Center. His original song, Brian, your original song, The Always Song, was Nickelodeon's 2021 Hispanic Heritage Month song. You've worked as an actor all over the place. I'm not even going to get into it, but in New York at the Roundabout Theater, the Public Theater, the Playwrights Realm, Actors Theater of Louisville. Okay, we're going to get into it. Victory Gardens and more. He's been on TV, on Blue Bloods. Search Party and Manhattan Love Story. You work as an educator. Yes.
Yes. Still do.
You're an adjunct musical solo performance professor with no rights who can be fired immediately and without cause at Harvard University. You've taught solo performance, social justice, verse acting, and devised theatrical looping master classes, which I'm going to sign up for because that sounds like fun.
It's the best.
Carnegie Mellon. That's at Carnegie Mellon University. You're a genius. You're going to get a MacArthur Genius Award.
Stop it.
Anyway, Brian, you won 2 Jeff Awards in Chicago, and you've got 2 nominations for Drama Desk Awards. You're a member of the Ensemble Studio Theater in New York City. We know those guys.
Shout out.
Yes. And you composed the music for Romeo and Juliet. And you're our guest in this episode of the bonus content series for Romeo and Juliet. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
Wow.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, that's it. Goodbye. Thank you.
That's my whole life.
We got it all. Thanks for participating, and we'll pay you whenever we can. You've been involved in Romeo and Juliet for a long, long time. This particular iteration. How did that come about?
Well, I have known Hansel Jung for many, many years. In fact, I was in the world premiere of her very first a play in the United States. Which happened in Idaho, good old Boise, Idaho.
Oh,
and that's where we met many, many years ago. And then years passed, and she saw that solo show, Where Did We Sit on the Bus, where I was looping in it. Uh-huh. Live looping, for those who don't know, is layered music making. You know, you usually have a little a little machine, and you put in a beatbox and it records for 8 bars, 4 bars, whatever, how many bars you want, or however much time. And then you add another layer and another layer, blah, blah, blah. And so she saw me doing that and she's like, oh, so you compose musicals now? And I said, I wrote this one. I mean, yeah, I get, I don't know. And I said, sure. And so she's like, okay, well, I have this play. Do you want to work on this musical? And that musical was called Undesirables. And it was a live looped 7-person musical. And that was a blast and really, really super hard. And we're still working on it. But the time came when she was working on a bunch of stuff and I was working on a bunch of stuff separately. And we, again, came together when she had this opportunity to adapt Romeo and Juliet in the play on adaptations, that huge project to adapt Shakespeare's work. She wanted to add music to it. And she's like, I think it'd be really fun. It was live looped. And that's the thing that I do. So I was like, okay, let's do it. And so that's how I kind of came on board initially to work on the music for Romeo and Juliet.
Now, when you say live looped, you mean like, so folks are with, actors are on stage with the loop machine and they're in the moment creating the thing that is being heard.
Correct. Yeah. So there's no like band, there's no live, there's no like tracks, like pre-recorded tracks. It's all, you know, they grab a guitar off the stage and, or they grab a French horn and start playing it into a microphone and then record that. And so it's kind of like a magic trick. You're like, what? These actors also play instruments? And then they also record them perfectly in time and make music. Yeah.
Does that mean that the actors are, is it like 50-50, or do all of them play instruments to be able to participate in that way?
Yeah, I mean, like we were able to find, you know, so we, before the podcast, we did a live production at Two River Theater, and also with Natco was a co-production.
Right.
And we were able to find a lot of musicians, actor musicians, I should say. And those who didn't play it, they were musical, I should say, even if the actors didn't play an instrument, like we're like, great, you're playing tambourine, you know, or like, here's the triangle.
Right. So everybody in that production had some access to some musicality.
Correct.
Did everybody use an instrument at some point?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, there was like, I mean, smatterings of, you know, Dustin Wills, incredible director. His kind of style of, you know, kind of making stuff is creating something beautiful out of chaos, I think.
Right. Right.
And so there was smatterings of instruments all over the stage that, you know, you could just whip something up and start playing, you know, ukulele, the harmonica, you know, it was just instruments everywhere.
Now, you're an actor and a composer, but in this production that they did at Natco and Two River, and obviously in the podcast, you've only done composition, right? You did not act in any of the roles. Is that hard for you? Are you like, I wish I could be up there right now?
A little bit, you know. I think over the years I absolutely 100% started writing self-servingly. You know, I wanted to perform in everything. And I think, you know, that is why I wrote a piece. I'm just like, I'm going to do all the things that I do well. I'm going to rap. I'm going to play instruments. I'm going to dance. I'm going to, like, you know, speak Spanish and, you know, like do a bunch of like stuff that I love doing, and, you know, show off a little bit and hopefully tell an awesome story. And what was great about, you know, starting off that way is that I was like super motivated in the writing. Cause I didn't have a lot, I didn't go to school for playwriting or composition, music composition. And so I was, you know, motivated by the fact and given confidence by the fact that, like, I had been a performer. You know, I went to school for that. That's, you know, like, spent a lot of my time working on new play development and kind of cutting my teeth in New York on new work and acting, performing. Mm-hmm. And so once I started writing, I think the beautiful transition of, you know, having it totally be a selfish act is that I think I was creating work for, like, for not only myself, but I think people that felt like I did, which was, like, you know, especially in a lot of actor musician things, you know, you tend to see a lot of $1 million quartets, the Onces, you know, and those don't offer a lot of opportunities for, you know, people of color. And so for me, it was really super beautiful to see that production that eventually led to the podcast of predominantly Asian cast. And it's amazing to me to, like, able to write music and provide opportunity in the way that I kind of felt it to others. So it in a weird way, like, it seems like writing seems greater than just me, you know. It's mm-hmm. it's for writing music is for everyone. So anyway, all to say, I actually enjoy sitting in the seat, all right? Like, I like listening to people interpreting the thing that I made.
Right. So in this iteration of this production, right, we don't get that joy of seeing the actors pick up the instrument and make the music. Obviously a challenge, right?
Yeah.
Going from stage to the podcast. How did you thread that needle? What was the process there? And what did you come up with to sort of make it feel like the actors were plucking things out of thin air?
Yeah. Well, I think the beautiful idea that came out of, you know, trying to take the stage adaptation and make it into a podcast was this idea that, you know, in looping, the idea is you're kind of on the fly making it. Looping was born out of Les Paul, the very famous guitarist who wanted to play rhythm guitar, record that in, and then loop on top of it, like, right on top of his already recorded rhythm. And so it is arguable that he was the first looper inventor, whatever. And so something born out of, you know, one person wanting to do something and in the hecticness of, like, okay, cool, I'm just going to do it right now and record myself on top of it. I think that translated very well to the stage, as in these actors were coming together, this troupe of actors were coming together to tell the story of Romeo and Juliet. And what's awesome is that out of the collaborative nature of, you know, Dustin and y'all and us as on the music team, it was really cool to get to this. Okay, what if they're walking into the studio and they're picking up all of these instruments that are in there, and you hear they're like, okay, cool, we're going to start from here. All right, great. What's the last thing that we did? And it felt organic in the studio that, like, it replicated it through in a sonic way of kind of the madness and hecticness of putting together a project, a podcast, a sonic project. And so I love the idea that you kind of hear a guitar coming up, or, like, you know, you hear the preparation for the music, so that the tracks, when they start playing, you're not like, oh, this is just a pre-recorded track. Like, it's actually Chris Vanno playing as Romeo playing the guitar. And I love that. I think it's so pure. It feels so pure. You know what I mean? And I love that.
Was this your first experience working on the play Romeo and Juliet? I mean, this production, the production that went, that Hansel translated.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I was a big fan of that Baz Luhrmann movie.
Uh-huh.
And obviously I've seen, it's my wife's favorite Shakespeare play. So every time it's playing anywhere, shows like, let's go see it. But I remember really loving that version, and actually that being the version that kind of like, also like, as a kid, I wanted to be John Leguizamo. So like him as Tybalt, I'm like, let's go. I think that's amazing. But actually, you know, I kind of got a keen through, I think writing the music actually, weirdly, for Mercutio, I was like, Mercutio is, what an amazing part. But it was kind of like working on this piece that, on this work, actually working on it, that I got to like actually really, I mean, fall in love with a lot of the characters, but Mercutio being like, I'd love to play Mercutio one day.
So Mercutio is the role that you identify with the most.
I think so, just because he's just bombastic and dumb and and
probably
just
plays out there. Music.
It definitely plays music. That guy totally goes and makes beats in his bedroom.
Can we talk about the rap, the Mercutio rap? How did that
totally
happen?
Yeah, so I mean, we were discussing, you know, a lot of the musical influences of the play, and she always felt that the Queen Mab speech, that very famous speech, like wanted some oomph. And I was like, I totally agreed. I mean, I think it's a beautiful speech, and I think it's awesome and so fun. And I agreed, and I was just like, yeah. And so my kind of background musical, my favorite genre of music is hip hop. And, you know, I think everything should be like, I think the Music Man should, like, the Music Man is a hip hop musical. It's like, you got trouble, my friends, right here, say trouble right here. You know what I mean? It's already. Yeah. And there's so many. Anyway, I'm just like, this could be an incredible speech, a version of the speech, if he does it like a rap.
She is the fairy's midwife, and she comes in shape no bigger than an agate stone. A team of little atom creatures draws her, or sleeping men's noses. Her chariot is an empty hazelnut.
And it already lends itself to hip-hop. Hip-hop being incredibly bombastic and kind of big, and big bravados, a lot of, you know, toasting, as they say, you know, a lot of like, okay, okay, here I am, I'm Mercutio. And it just lends himself, hip-hop kind of lends itself to very well to this big persona that Mercutio is.
With blisters greet, because their breaths are drenched in meaty sweets. Sometimes she comes with an altar boy.
So putting those two things, I'm like, okay, cool, I'm just going to adapt the speech into to fit the form of like a rap. And so once that happens, then you, once, as soon as you start making it lyrically into, I mean Shakespeare has already written it in meter, right? It's so easy to convert something like that into a lyrical rap song. The only thing that we kind of switched around was some of the rhyme schemes, so that they were couplets rather than rhyme A, rhyme B, rhyme A, right? You know, we kind of moved things around to make it sound a little more contemporary hip hop sounding. And so I kind of love that. And that leads to the beat making, to the kind of composition around the lyrics, the words, so that it kind of also explodes in this big, big produced beat. And it was a blast, truly. I love it.
What was the first piece of music that came out of the process for you in this production?
I think it was Romeo, finding what Romeo sounded like. Mm-hmm. Probably because, you know, I was working in chronological order, right? And he's kind of one of the first players introduced in this. Of the two, he's the first introduced. And when you break down Romeo in his essence, I feel like he's, you know, just like, he just wants to be in his feelings so hard, you know, he so badly wants to be in love, but like loves being in like heartbreak, and like, you know, just God swims in his own emotions, and God, it's just so I was just like, well, that sounds like, you know, and also like, you know, he's also not like the, I mean, you know, no shouts on Romeo, but like, I don't think he's like the most emotionally intelligent. And so I think that's where kind of Romeo's sound was born out of, was being like, no, let's make it like poppy, but like emotional poppiness, you know. Ed Sheeran, you know, Justin Bieber, John Mayer, like, I think it's, especially with the guitar, right? it felt like that was the kind of right essence. And then it wasn't until then that we were like, cool, now that we've decided that like he kind of lives in this style of music, that we moved to Juliet, who, you know, is incredibly smart and actually really emotionally intelligent. You know, she's like, she really actually knows how to talk through her feelings logically, and it's complex, and but she can't help herself. I mean, she's caught up in this. I mean, they're both young, right? Yeah. But for her, she definitely has this understanding of how she's feeling much more than Romeo. And so with her, I think we started moving to like, okay, well, what's the, if what's the antithesis of, you know, this pop, like boy, like young boy, emo, you know, style. And with her, you know, we're like, well, what if like it's somewhere between like Bjork, who is also very, you know, open vowels and like huge kind of like, but complicated. It doesn't fit into like a four chord cycle. It's like, it moves. It's almost operatic and sometimes, which is why we also like infused a little bit of opera into her representation. But it's different. I think it's like bigger and less predictable and still incredibly emotional music, I think. But that's kind of where we started trying to identify. I mean, isn't it the best? Like just being like, what does this character sound like? Or, you know, what is this? What is the music that is the theme song that if you were looking them out the window, walking down the street, that you would place music onto their walk or onto their essence, onto their character? And it's such a fun game to play, and it's useful, I think.
Did the process begin for you with like Romeo's music and Juliet's music before you knew who was playing what parts, or did it begin at the first table read? What's the entry point?
Yeah, I think the entry point was composing the musical. I write on guitar because it's my instrument of choice. It's the instrument that I play best. But you know, you can play anything that you play on guitar on piano. Or accordion, or you know, the banjo, the ukulele. You can play what I play. I mean, they're just, you know, notes on a scale. And so I typically tend to write the song first, in my own way, right? And because I think that's the thing, like the song and the melody is to me the essence of like that will always remain, and what it would depend, doesn't matter what instrument you're playing on, that remains the essence of the emotional connection to the piece. And so once you get your actors, you're like, cool, what do you play? If they only play the drums, it's a little complicated, you know. Right. Like, well, how do we get you to, you know, play something that has melody or, you know, notes? But what was cool is that the actors, both in the podcast and in the live production, played instruments, like played piano incredibly well and guitar really well. And we're able to sustain, I think, the because really at the end of the day, everybody else is kind of, their instrumentation is really just helping support these two keepers of melody, you know? Right. And they're also amazing singers. I mean, they sound so good.
Yeah. With this particular play, let's just use this as the, as if, right? You have a conversation with Hansel and Dustin. You talk about the concept or the ideas that you have for the production, and then you kind of go off and just mull it over and maybe pick up the guitar and just start strumming and find something that kind of lands right and get something down on paper, then bring it to the actor.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, but I mean, way before the actors, I think, involved, it took definitely some back and forth just between me, Hansel, and Dustin, you know, because I was like, based on this, on our conversations, this is what I think the music is. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you know, like, I'm composing music, but I want it to reflect the collaborative process of putting this together and what their vision is as writer, adapter, and director. And so I'll come to them and I'm like, this is what I think it is. You know, this is how I'm, this is my first stab at it. Like, you know, like, this is my shot. Yeah. And then they say, cool, yeah, but like this part right here. And I'm like, okay, that, let's talk about that part right there. And I'll be like, what does it sound like to you? And give me songs, give me like artists, give me instruments, give me like the time of day, give me a park or a warehouse. You know what I mean? Like, right. What is it? What does it sound like? And what I'm trying to do is narrow down what I think, because really, truly, I think that a composer's job in something like this is like to, as accurately or as closely as possible, get to the feeling that you want to feel. And so then I'll go back after we have a conversation and I'll recompose, like kind of rethink what I had made and get to the thing that I think is more like, you know, another attempt at getting to what I think the thing is. And then once we landed on like, yeah, this works, this makes you feel like, is the day so young? You know what I mean? And then you can take that to the actors and be like, try this on for size. And I'm also like really open collaboratively, like try this on for size. And if like, it, I mean, I write everything to fit my voice. And I'm a bass. So typically, you know, I'm like, yeah, I'm singing something when way let down register. I'm like, it might not fit for your voice, but like, let's find, this is the essence of it. Now let's make it work for you.
And then of course there are the actors who come in and obviously I'm sure they have their own ideas as well. And
yeah. And I'm super, I mean, a lot of people are like, a lot of composers will be like, I don't want you doing that run. You know what I mean? Like stick to the music. I'm not like that. I come from being an actor first. And so I'm like, no, like, let me own it. Let me make the thing mine. And so when I work with actors, I recognize that like, they want to be making it their own. It's just fits more comfortable. I mean, sometimes I'll be like, no, don't do that. But for the most part, I feel like I'm incredibly collaborative when it comes to, you know, taking my music and putting it onto, I mean, they have to do it, you know, they have to sing it and play it.
Is this your, how much experience did you have just working on any Shakespeare prior to this?
I did A Midsummer Night's Dream, Michael, in high school. I was played Puck.
Oh, that's not a small role.
It's not a small role.
Puck could be a musician.
I think so too. I wish I had another shot at it. I was young and I had a blast. It was such a magical production. Some really funny people were, you know, in the mechanicals in that high school production.
Where was high school? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Highwood, which is a small town surrounded by a much bigger town called Highland Park on the north side of Chicago. And Highland Park, so like Highwood is like the small kind of like Latino Italian town surrounded by Highland Park, which had it's pretty affluent town, which where all the 90s Chicago Bulls lived, because the training facility was in the town next over. And so luckily my parents moved to this town that funneled all of its students to this high school that had a lot of money. And so I got really lucky that, you know, because of the public school that I went to, we had like two separate theater teachers. I mean, I was part of like a four different choral groups. I got really lucky that, you know, our school was so arts forward. Mm-hmm. And really, that's where like my love. I mean, my family is pretty musical. My dad plays guitar. My parents sang in the church choir.
Was guitar the first instrument that you learned?
Yeah, I had my dad try to teach me once, and he was just the worst teacher. Yeah. And so for a while, I was just like, I'm not playing guitar. And it wasn't until I went to college until that I started learning how to play guitar. And then once I started playing guitar, kind of everything, you know, because I also kind of discovered looping, I think as a sophomore in college, mm-hmm. I wanted to like keep adding instruments. I'm like, cool, I've looped in guitar. What else can I loop in? And so I just started picking up instruments to, you know, I say I'm like a jack of all trades, master of none. I play a lot of different instruments poorly, but well enough to record it once.
And for a composer, that's actually.
Oh, it's great. I mean, it's great. Although, you know, like I think now, you know, keyboards, you can make them sound like anything. So as long as you play the keys, you kind of play everything. But yes, no, good for, I think, just like understanding. It's nice to play a bunch of instruments when you're just like, I know the use of these instruments in a larger composition. You know, I know what a snare will do. I know when that kick comes in, you are like grooving to that kick. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I think it's nice to play all these instruments and approach them slowly so that you know their effect when using them in a large composition.
Join Play On Premium to get merch like t-shirts, hoodies, and coffee mugs, ad-free episodes, and bonus content video featuring interviews with the actors, producers, playwrights, and directors who brought it all to life. Go to ncpodcasts.com and subscribe to Play On Premium to support the art and the artists.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
Where do you go for inspiration? Who do you listen to?
I really, truly try to listen to everything. And I used to say that I didn't love country, but like, I think there's something really valuable to like the storytelling in country, or like, yeah. Kind of, you know, a lot of country is really super simple. It's in a 4-chord structure. It's very easy to loop. And like really beautiful storytelling. And a lot of the times they're, because I'm a bass and because I can't sing super high, they're the best karaoke songs. Yeah, they're always pretty typically. Johnny Cash is like go-to because it's low. But yeah, I mean,
a friend of mine told me about, okay, like this is how out of the country loop I am. But he introduced me to Eric Church. I'd never listened to Eric Church. I didn't know who he was.
I've never listened to Eric Church.
And man, I spent an entire weekend just listening to all these songs and thinking, what a great storyteller.
I'm gonna listen to Eric Church. You see?
There we go.
Yeah, no, I listen to every. I tend to stick to. I do go back to like a lot of Motown stuff and a lot of kind of like '90s R&B and hip hop, and that's what I tend. That's like I think my comfort music, just because I grew up with it, and like you know, I think like also 1950s like. Golden age Mexican trio boleros, like just because my parents used to listen to that all the time. But I think there's something really that I find incredibly valuable about keeping like a pulse on what people are listening to, like what other people are listening to and why, you know, just because music is so universal. It's just so, it I listen to stuff in other languages too, just like, K-pop and, with the global kind of effect that hip hop has had, I'll listen to like African hip hop and like South American hip hop. Like there's amazing groups coming out of like
Is it just
Argentina,
like
Brazil.
pick an artist on Spotify and or Pandora and just let
Totally.
the robot pick the
Yeah,
do
yeah.
the
I mean, a little bit
rest?
of that. Yeah, for sure. I mean, there are those like, I'm actually grateful for those like, top pop hits or whatever. Like, and I'll just like, yeah, I'll put it on. I'll see what the kids are listening to. What's playing on TikTok?
A lot of it is really good. My
it
kids are bringing
is.
me stuff. They're
Totally. You're
introducing
like,
me to
oh man,
music.
this is pretty hot.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's good. I think it's good to like be kind of, I mean, you have your comforts, you have your comfort music. And for me, it's like those like, yeah, those like kind of like super easy to listen to like Motown. I mean, it's like put Marvin Gaye and The Temptation, like give God, I could listen to that forever.
Oh, yeah.
It's so easy. It's so good. And I think a lot of that songwriting was like simple, but like so soulful. That even if you didn't speak English or like didn't, even if you like they were mumbling their words, you would know what they were singing about,
Do you compose on a looping machine, or do you do it on like GarageBand? What program do you do?
Yeah, so I mean, if I'm composing anything like just bare bones scratching, like, because I think it's about the song. First, it's the song. It's just me and the guitar. And then as soon as I'm like, cool, that's the song, I'm like, is it on guitar? Should I record it in a guitar, or should I play that chord cycle on keys into my program? And I will do that into a loop machine. Because for the most part, unless it's a jazz song or unless it doesn't loop, I like the repetition of something happening a lot, a lot, a lot. Like I like listening to it over and over and over. And so I'll put it into a loop machine. Put all the colors that I want, like everything. It's just going to be a smattering of a bunch of different elements of the song. And then once I have all those smatterings, if it isn't a live loop show, then I'll start taking those sounds and putting it into Logic or GarageBand or, I mean, right now we're currently working on a show called Mexodus here in Baltimore Center Stage, and we're working on Ableton. It's not my it's the best loop. It's actually the best looping work. What do they call that? Work tape? DAW. It's currently the best workstation for looping.
It's what's it called?
Called Ableton.
Ableton.
But like Logic, like GarageBand, it's very similar but different. Yeah, I'll
No,
take those.
no.
I'll take my loops and I'll put them in there and arrange them so that I can send them to a notationist so that they can copy it and make it readable for musicians.
I'm always hearing music in my head, but I always think to myself, well, I can't do that. I can't put that. I'm not a composer. I would love to be able to put that down, but now you can.
You can. And I will say that, like, let's just say that you're also, I mean, I encourage everybody to learn instruments because I think it's good and humbling and makes you understand like how difficult being a musician is.
Oh, yeah.
But like if that seems intimidating, before I was really, really good at guitar, I mean, I sang in the choir since I was in middle school, right? And so I would make like I would go like dum 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 bum. You know what I mean? And I would make
Right.
compositions with just my voice, replicating, making like a cappella versions of my favorite songs. And then some of my first looping compositions were done with my voice. And you could feasibly like make an entire composition vocally, give that to an orchestrator or like, somebody who does know instruments well, and make your vocal arrangement into an actual song. You know what I mean? And so I think
Wow.
that's remarkable that like just within yourself, you have one of the most beautiful instruments like already given to you in your body, that can be translated into whatever. You could write an entire musical with your mouth, you know?
That is so cool.
Yeah.
So what was the point of departure for you? I shouldn't say departure, but I guess growth, right? So you were interested in acting. You were an actor, or you are an actor. When did music sort of introduce itself to you as this other form of creative self-expression?
I was always musical. I always loved music. I come from a family that loves music. In fact, I think so much so that we're uncomfortable in a silent room. Sunday mornings were people battling over who could play their music the loudest from coming from different rooms. And so I've always loved it. And I think that the American theater music canon, the American musical, like I love musical theater, love it, adore it so much so. But I always felt like I was like a 17-year-old kid with like this voice trying to play what, you know? Like it I could like I didn't find my place in it. I loved performing, and I was just like, cool, like the only part I can play right now is like at, in a leading role is like Man of La Mancha, you know? He's like the only bass, like, or you know, it's just
It's all
doesn't
written
happen.
for tenors, right? I mean,
Exactly. It's just like because the thing is to belt your face off, and I could never do that. And so for a long time I resented that, or like I was like, oh, I hate my voice because like it's so low. And you know, now I'm getting to an age where I think, you know, I'm beginning to play dads. And so like now, you know, you're like, oh, okay, yeah, that guy has a low voice. And but I think for a long time I just didn't, you know, find my place in it. And that's why like I was just like, cool, well, I don't need musical theater. Like I'm still an actor, you know, and I spent a lot of my career just acting in straight in musicless plays, until I think, you know, I discovered that I could, I mean, I've always loved rapping, and that I could add hip hop into musical theater, and you know, as soon as, you know, hip hop theater has been a movement that has been around for a long time, and of course with Lin-Manuel writing his musicals, it's kind of kicked down the door for hip hop theater, but that felt like my like I could do that stuff. I could rap really fast. I could rap in a way that had the cadences, and you know, and so that was kind of my first entry point. And now that I'm writing musicals, like proper musicals, and writing music like for Romeo and Juliet, I'm very aware of people's ranges, and like I'm like I think it's also smart to like be adding to have those high singers, but also to like create a foundation with these low singers. I'm just super aware because I think I felt so uninvited by the canon that now as I am participating in what the continued canon is, I'm making sure that there's like bass parts and like really good alto parts.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your one man show, Where Did We Sit on the Bus?
Yeah.
There's music in that, I'm assuming. Rap.
Yeah. I mean, they're saying, I mean, like in all rap, I think there's like a little, you know, I mean, even, you know, like look at Drake, and that guy is just like kind of singing, you know, they're
Yeah.
like singing, but they're rapping.
Was that the play? Was that for you the sort of the your birth in this sort of new composer actor trajectory?
100%. Yes. I had been in like rap theater projects. And those were my favorite. I just loved being in them. And I think I wasn't getting enough of those. So that's why I decided to like write one where I'm like, I want to keep rapping. And so I did. And I wrote that. And like, you know, at that point, I had been dabbling. I had been like making music. I think I wrote that, you know, I mean, I was maybe like 3 or 4 years out of college, and like, you know, spent 4 years working on straight plays, except for like a few kind of hip hop projects. And I was just like, okay, come on, let's go. What do I need to do? And then I wrote music for that just on the side. I didn't know that I was a composer. I just love making music, you know, like you paint, but you don't call yourself a painter. You know what I mean? Until like you sell your first painting, right? And you're like, am I a paint? Should I do this? And so it was exactly like that. I like wrote this play. I had no idea what would come of it. I thought I would like open a garage door, start looping, and people would stop and say, what is this? And like, pay attention for a little. I had no idea that like we would go on like a 5-year tour. I mean, people are doing, it's about to start rehearsals in the Denver Center with another actor who's looping.
Wow.
And it's amazing. I mean, just cause she's been doing it for 4 years touring the show. And I think I'm a little like that show 100% changed my life and validated me as a musician and a composer and as a writer too. It was the first thing I ever wrote. And so, yeah.
Where does the title come from?
Yeah. In the third grade in Highwood, Illinois, I remember asking my third grade teacher during a lesson on the civil rights and Martin Luther the King and Rosa Parks, where Latinos sat on the civil rights buses.
Mm.
And she like took a pretty deep breath and a long silence and was like, they weren't around. The answer is complicated because the answer is there wasn't protocol, right? So
right.
Depending on, I mean, I honestly go through this back. I go through this all the time because I'm just like, how brown am I? You know what I mean? Like
right.
where do I sit on the bus? Like, I guess it's subjective to one bus driver. I might like a white person to another. I'm just like, no, that guy's definitely Latino. You know what I mean? And
right.
So I think I still go through it of like, what is my relationship to black and white in this spectrum that is America? And also just like the world, because I think the entire world is very conscious of color. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the step, I remember going home and that question being the thing that made me ask a lot more questions to my parents, like, where did we come from? Like, when did we get here? And who are we? And hearing immigration stories and being like, oh my God, my name is Brian. Like, separated by 20 years, my name would not have been. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
I have the whitest name. And so, like, I think that experience led to a much deeper examination of my identity and my race and my culture and my family. And so that's what the kind of show is about. It's a kind of a coming of age story. But yeah, I mean, like, since that show, I have communicated. She came to see the show, my teacher, and she's lovely. And she was like 31 when that happened, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm like older than she is. She was then when that happened. And, you know, like, I'm not mad. Like, you know, that's an incredibly tough answer to give to an 8-year-old.
Right.
And have him understand. So like, I think for me, I'm actually grateful that it happened, that was the answer, because it led to a lot of good, healthy questions at home.
Right. So yeah. Are you first generation?
Yeah. My parents came in the 70s.
From Mexico?
From El Salvador.
El Salvador. Through Mexico? Or how did they?
Through Mexico. Yeah, they took buses to get to the border and cross through the desert.
So did and how did they end up in Chicago, in the Chicago area?
Yeah, I don't know why the first lineage, because we ended up in Chicago because my dad's older sister had moved to Highwood in the Chicagoland area. I'm not quite sure. And I don't know why she had moved. I don't know if there was another family member who had left a little bit before, but they found this little nook of like a kind of an affordable town to live in, where my aunts and then my mom could clean the houses of the rich folks in the town next door.
Mm.
in the town next to us. And right. So and that's why we went to a really nice public school, is because, you know, we live next to that town. And so that's why I don't know why the people before our family came, or like, you know, my aunts came to that specific town. But like, you know, I think it was the opportunity, like the market, you know, they were able to kind of work, find a job that could, that they could, you know, buy a house and to have their kids go to a nice school.
So they left El Salvador. How old were they when they left?
My dad was in his early 20s. My mom was 17.
Wow. Were they escaping economic hardship?
Yeah, I mean, El Salvador was in a different, a really different economic place. I mean, my dad says you could work and you're still starving, you know, like, yeah. It's like really hard. But also, you know, they left kind of right on the precipice of the Salvadoran War.
Right.
So the country was not in a good place. I just went back this January, and I hadn't been back there in 23 years. And I went on a research trip, a new play, and it's amazing. I mean, it's remarkably different. It's, you know, now they're like, the country isn't actually, it's economically growing. I mean, like, now that the war is over, and it's now, as of this year, this past year, the safest country in the Western Hemisphere.
Okay.
Now people are going, and it's like got the best surfing in the world. It's got the best coffee in the world. Like, it is now opening its doors to be like, come and kick it in this country and boost this economy.
Do your parents talk about going back?
Now that I went, and I'm like, guys, it was amazing, because they haven't been in like 15 years. So now, and the music is so good, and like, it's just an incredible place. And I can't believe, I mean, no, I know why it took me so long to go, but now that it's like, you know, safe and, you know, people are happy, it's really remarkable. Now I'm like, let's take another family trip when everybody's an adult, you know?
Did you grow up speaking Spanish?
Yeah. It was like my first language up until I went to school. And, you know, they actually put me in the ESL class first. And then they were like, but we don't have enough room. There was only one ESL class at the time. Now they've got a bunch, but there was only one ESL. And they didn't have enough space for me. So they put me in the English speaking class. And they were like, he'll be fine. He has an older brother who speaks English. And it's true. And so I was in the English class, and that's kind of where I started like being like, okay, cool. And then transitioning over to English. But my parents still in the house were very adamant about us speaking Spanish. They didn't want us to lose it.
That's great.
And it's great.
And so your mom did house cleaning. What did your dad do?
My dad was a construction goods trucker. So not any cross country stuff of like, you know, shipping merchandise from one state to another. It was like, you're picking up sand and you're picking up sand from here and you're bringing it over to the Oakland, you know, beach, or you're picking up, wood chips and you're bringing it over to the suburb of Winnetka. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like bringing material construction goods, or like, you know, to different locations, either for private companies or for cities that are doing, you know, we're doing work.
Were they able to get citizenship?
Yeah. I mean, like, I talked to my parents, and I think we have two different understandings of the American dream. Like, the American dream for them is the fact that they could work and support a family. Right. And they did it, like, truly. That's why I think they had no interest in going back to El Salvador. They're just like, why? America offered us the American dream. Like, we got it. And to me, and I think this is where, like, I think we had a lot of differences, is that my American dream is that you can do that doing whatever you want, whatever you love.
Was it hard for them to see you go into the arts?
Oh my God, Michael, let's not even get into it. So hard. But I think now they're
life and limb to get you to a safe place where.
Yeah, exactly. They were like, oh God, we came here and you want to make music? They were not happy for a long, long time. I mean, probably until a few years ago, you know, when I was just like, I mean, it helps to be on TV, right? Like, they're just like, that's our son, you know? Yeah. But also, like, you know, as soon as, like, you know, I'm just like, I live off of what I make, you know? Yeah. And they are like, cool. Or, like, you know, I'll be like, guys, let me buy you, let's go on vacation, you know? Like, mm-hmm. And I'm paying with something that you thought I wasn't possible, you know? Right. And it's not like, you know, I'm like they know I'm like, I'm not rich, but that they know that I'm like incredibly happy doing the thing that I do. And it's keeping me alive. You know, I'm able to feed myself and have an apartment in New York. You know, it's they now understand that like our American dreams are different. And but I am also, I mean, you know, I write a lot of, you know, if it isn't Romeo and Juliet, like I write a lot of stories about the border and about immigration and in a way that's kind of my way of paying tribute to them, right? Like all this music, all these like poems, all these plays are like in a lot of ways just paying tribute to my folks.
And Mexodus, the play you're doing now at Baltimore Center Stage, are you one of the creators of this?
Yeah, so I wrote it with my friend Nigel D. Robinson. I remember seeing an article on history.com on Facebook. It was called the Undertold Story of the Underground Railroad That Led South to Mexico. Hmm. And I remember reading that article and being like, how have I never heard about this? One, and two, Mexico abolished slavery 30 years before we did. Of course it makes sense.
Right.
That like slaves in Texas were like, why could we go north when we could literally cross the Rio Grande and be free in Mexico? And so about 4,000 to 10,000 slaves escaped. It's hard because it was so secretive to like know the actual number. But I was just like, oh, wow, that is like a reverse border story. It is like that same line, but you're leaving the United States to go into Mexico for safety and for a better dream, you know? And so I became incredibly moved by this piece of history that I didn't know about. Specifically also because of my parents and crossing that same border. And then as soon as I met Nigel D. Robinson, who was another fellow actor musician, who was also the music director on Romeo and Juliet, the podcast.
Yes.
As soon as I met him and realized that he was an actor musician, we started working on this piece in the pandemic. And now we're about to start tech today for the world premiere in Baltimore Center Stage of that play.
Wow. What a story. Borders, huh? Borders.
Borders.
Borders. What are they?
I don't know. Blind, really, what imaginary are they? Lines in the sand.
Yeah. And that obviously, you know, ultimately, just like currency, it's a totally. Figment of the imagination.
Totally.
And we just kind of agree on this is the boundary. But yeah. Obviously, history and human migration and, you know, circumstance makes them almost irrelevant when you look at the great scope of things.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's really, and it, you know, for as much as, you know, it continues to be it continues to be used as the talking point, the kind of let's get you heated, you know. Right. There's bills that could be passed that could probably solve some things, but aren't, to continue to talk about it.
Oh,
you know?
I mean, it couldn't be more obvious than what just happened, right? I mean, Congress had the bill that everybody agreed on, and you know, the Republican nominee for president, Trump, said, "No, no, 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 don't do this. I don't have anything to run on if you pass this legislation."
I mean, it's so silly, and so, I mean, it's just sad, you know, because I think, you know, it's something that, like, to me, it's not a political talking. It's just my parent. It's just logical. It's just, it just makes sense. And it's so, you know, I see my folks being like so happy and like being like, this is, you know, we built this here, you know, in the same, like, it seems silly to that we're so proud of a green statue that says, please bring those who are tired and poor. And we shouldn't have it up then. And we shouldn't be so proud of it.
It's the duality of, you know, what we say we are and what we do. Right. And we hope that eventually those things come together in a positive way.
Totally. And you know, like, I think that where I fall in weirdly is in making art, you know, like, I'm like, in making art is the clearest to me, like, it is just a funnel for, like, empathy. It is just an opportunity to see into the experience of another person, right? Even if we're talking about, like, Romeo and Juliet, you know, you watch and you know that this story has been around forever and told in so many different ways, but you feel love like a 16-year-old. You're like, you know, you're like, oh, therefore, are you not happy? You know what I mean? Like, you're feeling and connecting to these characters in a way that, even though the language perhaps isn't, you know, how we speak in our vernacular today, or even if there's like music attached to it, like, it's why we go to the theater. It's why we listen to stories, because it's trying to make you connect to something within and trying to, like, open that door of empathy a slight crack so that hopefully there's a little more. So, like, even though, like, I'm in, you know, we're artists, and I think there is some activism to it. And it's the way that I feel like I can say something of that meaning, like, have a platform in which to say something that hopefully makes the world, like, a tiny bit better, you know?
Well, we should leave it there because that's profound and that's true. You know, I'm always amazed, you know, Hadestown is a great example for me. You know, we know the story of Orpheus and Eurydice. It's been around since the beginning of Western storytelling history, the ancient Greeks. And, you know, we go to see Hadestown. We're told it's the story of Orpheus, and we know how it's going to end. He's going to get turned to stone when he looks and checks on his soulmate. And yet we go through that musical, and just as you say, the music, the words, the thoughts, the emotions lull us into hoping that it's going to be different this time.
Yeah.
And there I was crying like a baby at the end of Hadestown.
Yeah.
Because he turned around and turned to stone.
Totally. It's pretty powerful stuff. Pretty powerful stuff.
It is. It is.
Yeah.
And so, okay, Mexidus, Baltimore Center Stage. If you're hearing this interview shortly after we recorded it, then you better get down there and see it if you're anywhere near Baltimore.
We're also going to Mosaic in D.C., and that runs May 15th through June 17th. Those dates could be wrong, but if you go to Mosaic Theater DC's website, you could probably get those dates.
Awesome. Do you know what's next after that?
We are trying to actually line up like a little bit of a tour for Mexidus. I'm also going to be doing my second solo show in DC at First Stage, which is also live looped. Why do I do this to myself?
Because you're a creative person.
Yes. I'm doing my second solo show called Fly Me to the Sun at First Stage. And just writing. I'm just writing. Writing that play about coffee in El Salvador and writing a bunch of new things. There's plenty of things cooking, but that's what this year looks like.
Well, I'm going to have fun following your footsteps and seeing what you're doing, and I hope.
Likewise, Michael.
I hope we get you back to do more incredible compositions for us and other work.
Oh yeah, it would be my pleasure. It would be my absolute pleasure.
There you go, Brian Quijada. Friends, as I've said before, you can reach me, Michael, at ncpodcast.com. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the podcast that we're creating here at Next Chapter Podcast, especially the Play On podcast and the things we're doing in scripted fiction. Michael at ncpodcast.com. You've been listening to the Play On podcast bonus content series, and you can listen and learn more about the Play On podcast at Next Chapter Podcast website, ncpodcast.com. That's N as in next, C as in chapter, podcast with an S at the end.com, where you can find other Play On podcast series and interviews, along with talk podcasts like The 500, Indecent with Kiki Anderson, Beef with Bridget Todd, and a whole lot more. I'd like to thank Jeremiah Tittle. He's the founder of Next Chapter Podcast, and he's my producer on these series, and also is Pete Musto, our audio engineer, editor, and sound designer on this interview. Be sure to subscribe to Next Chapter Podcast for updates on all the latest content, and don't forget to rate and review our shows. That really makes a difference. I'm Michael Goodfriend, and I look forward to sharing more incredible works in the Play On Podcast series with you, along with lots of enlightening bonus content at Next Chapter Podcast.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Next Chapter Podcasts.